Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. There is an unnamed major player in the 2016 presidential election race, and that is money. The size of a candidate's campaign war chest is often a better predictor of his or her odds of winning than, say, platform, personal integrity, education, or values. As the length of the primary season grows, so does the amount of time candidates have to raise money that they will then proceed to flood media networks with for commercials. Soon after the last presidential election, John Nichols and Robert McChesney wrote an important book about the changing landscape of money in U.S. elections, especially after the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. John Nichols is the Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine and a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, an associate editor of The Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. Bob McChesney is a professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and has authored or edited nearly two dozen books. The book by Nichols and McChesney is called Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. I started by asking McChesney and Nichols about the last presidential election. From the broad national perspective, what should we learn from that election in terms of campaign donations? And what is this money and media election complex that you discuss in your book?
Well, what Bob, we learned, this is Bob here, what we learned was the amount of spending shot through the roof in the 2012 election cycle in America. We actually went through and did the crunching to figure out how much was spent, because there's no one who keeps track of this. There's no government recording of it, who's spending what. And it comes up to over $10 billion was spent on the 2012 election cycle for national elections, state and local elections, double what was spent just 4 years earlier, 10 times what was spent 20 years earlier, even allowing for inflation. And to put this in context, this is so striking, Germany just held national elections a month ago. And Germany's the richest economy in Europe, 80-some million people. It's a major democracy in the world today. And for all the money the parties and politicians spent per voter in Germany, for every dollar they spent in their national election, we spent in the United States $32 per voter in the United States in 2012 in our national elections, congressional and presidential. So we're way off the grid. We're spending money like no other country on the planet, no other democracy. And the problem we face is that most of the money is going to what are called political ads, or what we know as political ads. And most of those political ads now, 90% of them are negative ads. They're attack ads. These ads are illegal in most countries. You don't see them in Germany or Sweden or Britain or Denmark or Japan. They're considered to political campaigning what chemical warfare is to conventional battle. So they're just considered obscene, propagandistic, inappropriate for political debate and dialogue. Well, they are the lingua franca of the United States. Now, and the other part of our argument is that as we've seen this huge amount of money coming almost entirely from very wealthy people that dominates it, that's who was liberated by Citizens United, billionaires, people can spend $10 million a year. As we've seen this huge increase in money going to buy these ads, at the same time, we've seen the collapse of journalism. It's an ongoing process. It's been taking a generation, but now it's really on its death throes, commercial journalism in the United States. There's no resources for it. There's hardly any political coverage left that goes at the intersection of corporate interest and government and who's doing what and the nature of the relationship. State capitals, city halls are barely covered compared to a generation ago. And when voters go to the ballot box, when they go to be citizens, they look at a place where, except for the top line on the ballot, they have no news coverage whatsoever, anything on the ballot. They're really clueless except for political advertising. And the caliber of the journalism you see for the races at the top, for president or for a statewide race like senator or governor, tends to be inane. Most of the analysis is punditry. It's pointless debate of the latest poll. I mean, it really has almost no nutritional content. So this is the great crisis that we're in the midst of and that Ted Cruz is doing his best to further.
Right. And John, in California, you're saying didn't see the...
I was amused by your...
We weren't immune from
I was amused by your wonderful optimism, Sonali. What a grand soul you are. And obviously, I stole the term uprising for my book, so I honor
welcome.
You in every term. this is an interesting thing because obviously what Bob said kind of gives us this broad framework. But the, if you will, and I love this, this is one of the horrible terms of contemporary discourse, the value added of our book is that we didn't just turn it around quickly. We began 3 years ago when the Citizens United ruling came down. Literally within days of that ruling, we wrote a cover story. We wrote a cover story for The Nation. There was a tremendous amount of interest in it, and we determined at that point, with the 2012 election cycle not even begun, that we were going to step back, put all of our assumptions aside, not look at this thing as a continuum, but say, okay, if we come at this with no assumptions, how does America elect a president, a Congress, but also state and local officials? How does it choose what to do in referendums? What is it? How does America hold an election today? And we were blown away because what was revealed to us as we went through this process was, A, as Bob says, we have huge numbers of races across this country that are literally not covered. And we were talking statewide races for positions like lieutenant governor in Illinois, where a guy got nominated because he spent $2 million in the primary. And then once he was nominated, they found out he had, you know, questions about spousal abuse, questions about drugs, questions about his – huge questions about his business. I mean, it was a nightmare situation. He had to stand down. And so that lack of coverage creates a horrible situation. But the money was what was really amazing to us. And we went through all races, not just the presidential race, but we went down to local races. We went into referendums and initiatives. And so when you said California wasn't so affected by this, you're right at the presidential level. Mm-hmm. But in California in 2012, $550 million, more than half $1 billion, was spent on your initiatives. And so this state saw dollarocracy on steroids. That money flowed into this state, and it defined elections in good directions and bad. But you know, let's be honest. Do you really think Californians don't want to know if their food is genetically modified?
Right. The GMO labeling initiative just narrowly failed.
But didn't narrowly get the money thing was a big difference.
Absolutely.
There. And we saw that across this country in states like Michigan, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on these down ballot on referendums. Maryland, over $100 million spent on a gambling referendum. Well, what happens when that dollarocracy goes into play? It shapes the discourse. It tells us what is possible and what is not. And so the final thing that we come away from all this is, you know, we can talk a lot about parties and we can talk a lot about politicians, but what we have to understand is that certain issues become acceptable for discourse or unacceptable based on whether the money is flowing. And the media reflects that. Best example we have is obviously the GM referendum here, but in the state of Michigan, the place where the United Auto Workers Union was founded, kind of a core labor state. If you were to say, what's a labor state in America? Say Michigan. And yet in November of 2012, Michigan had a referendum to enshrine collective bargaining rights, to say that these are protected. You can't mess with collective bargaining rights in our state. It lost after a huge inflow of money from outside the state. People like Sheldon Adelson,
there you go,
pouring money into Michigan and getting Michigan to vote against labor rights. That's the power of dollarocracy.
Let's go back a little bit and talk about what the Citizens United decision was based on, the origins of it. One of the things you write about in your book is that the ruling was apparently based on a framework written by a man named Lewis Franklin Powell Jr. Who was this man, Powell, and how far back did the scheme go?
Well, I think that that's a great question. What we do in the book is we want to explain dollarocracy as a historical phenomenon in the train of American history. And to put it bluntly or to encapsulate, you know, from 1900 to 1970, we won a lot of great victories in this country, progressive forces. You know, the right to union, Social Security. We reduced poverty. We reduced inequality in this country dramatically from 1900 to 1970. We made this a much better country in many respects. And the future was very bright to most Americans in 1970. I was one of them. American teenagers were among the three most optimistic groups of teenagers in the world in 1970. We no longer are. And I think that the optimism wasn't shared across the board. By 1970, the business community, the corporate community, wealthy Americans like the Koch brothers and people like that were alarmed at what was happening. They saw an America that was really getting out of hand from their perspective. They saw an America in which business wasn't running the government anymore and that the respect for business domination was no longer shared. They saw an America where they frankly said African Americans, blacks, Hispanics, women, students, young workers have much too much power. They're getting too uppity. They're making demands on the system we're not used to seeing. And there was really a counter-revolution that began in the 1970s. And dollarocracy is the end game of that counter-revolution. That's the historical train. Right. Lewis Powell was the leading corporate attorney, or one of the leading corporate attorneys in America representing the tobacco industry, and had been the president of the American Bar Association. And the Chamber of Commerce commissioned him to write a short memo, which was spread confidentially to 50 or 60 leading corporate CEOs and billionaires, saying, what can business and wealthy Americans do to sort of take back the government? And Powell laid out a game plan, a battle plan, a strategy and tactics for how the government could be brought back under business control. First and foremost, he said, we've got to increase business spending on politics. And that's when K Street began. There's a 10 times increase in corporate lobbying between 1971 and 1990. That's when we also saw politicians, when they leave Congress, instead of going back to retire in their home and teach college classes, now suddenly moved to K Street and made huge increases in salary. That became the final job for a politician, was going to K Street and make $1 million a year rather than going retiring and going back to your hometown. And it changed the politics of the country, both Republican and Democrat, moving it way off so that the range of legitimate debate in Washington went from GE to GM. Now, Lewis Powell was obsessed with one thing. He really thought it was crucial that billionaires and corporations be allowed to spend as much as they want in elections. That way, he said, you can pretty much guarantee a positive outcome. If we can spend what we want, we'll get the America we want. We'll get the America where business runs everything. And he, you know, this was something from the very beginning. And ironically, just 2 weeks or 2 months after he wrote that memo and it was spread around to the corporate community confidentially, there was an opening on the U.S. Supreme Court. And guess who Richard Nixon appointed? Lewis Powell. He became a justice. And as soon as he got on the court, for his entire reign there, he was obsessed with unleashing the ability of the wealthiest 0.1% of Americans, billionaires and corporate CEOs and corporations, to spend as much as they want on election campaigns, completely against the entire history of American election management throughout our country's history, and that every vote, every state, local, and national law on the subject. And he was shot down on this. He couldn't get his way. William Rehnquist, the then conservative Chief Justice, opposed it. He said, this is simply unacceptable. Corporations aren't people. We've got to have fair elections. Believe it or not, William Rehnquist was the opponent of Powell. Well, when Rehnquist left, his replacement, John Roberts, the current Supreme Court Chief Justice, came in, and he was right out of Powell's playbook. From the beginning, he was itching to unleash all money. And that's what he got in the Citizens United case. Now, what Citizens United did, and it's very important to be clear on this, it did not say that billionaires, corporations, or labor unions, and some of our older listeners might remember what those are, or labor unions can give unlimited money to any campaign. They could give them to third-party groups, which weren't connected to the campaign, technically, so that the campaign itself still was could be governed by national or local rules on campaign limits. But, I mean, it said these groups couldn't be connected to the campaign. But as we quickly learned, there was no regulatory mechanism, and it became a farce. And it was pretty understood at the time it was a farce. It was a shameless decision. The other thing that Robert said in his decision was that, well, we don't have to worry at all about corruption from this. There's no concern whatsoever because this will all be made public through the internet, and people will be able to see who gave money on the internet, and therefore no billionaire or politician would dare do anything corrupt for fear of being exposed on the internet. Again, a ludicrous claim at the time and one that doesn't hold up. And if we didn't have a shameless court, they would meet again and they'd say we were completely flawed in our reasoning in that decision to get rid of it. But we have a court like Lewis Powell's court that isn't about improving elections and democracy. Their commitment is to shrinking democracy. I mean, that's what the whole movement's been about. They're scared to death of democracy. I think the people are behind Dollarocracy, behind Citizens United, behind the McCutcheon decision that's coming up, are people doing everything in their power to limit the ability of elections to be effective, to make it harder for people to vote, and make it less likely elections will actually reflect the will of the people of this country.
Now, of course, the impact of Citizens United was tremendous, but it isn't guaranteed, right? I mean, Sheldon Adelson, his donations, he didn't win everything he wanted last year. People are able to see through this, and there's a huge outrage among the public about Citizens United, but of course it's among those people who do follow the news.
Well, let's unpack that good question, okay? First off, let's talk about Sheldon Adelson. And we like Sheldon Adelson. Bob and I are big fans of his because because he talks. Mm. Most people who give money don't want to talk about it, right? In fact, it's on the down low. I'm going to slip that $100 million in, but don't send me a thank you note. Sheldon Adelson's glad to take the thank you note. He's glad to do the interview about it. And the fascinating thing about Sheldon Adelson is that after the 2012 election, when he put about $200 million in, mostly to try and elect first the imminently qualified Newt Gingrich, and then turned and went for Mitt Romney, after all that, there's a lot of things. Oh, Sheldon Adelson, the biggest loser, right? I mean, this guy, what a loser. So he flies into Washington, D.C. about a month later. And the funny thing, he wasn't greeted as a loser. Every door is open.
Really?
He's welcome. Because in the Dollarocracy, and Sheldon Adelson summed it up very well. He had a quote. He said, "This is I run casinos. There's always a next game. There's always another hand to be dealt." And so everybody in politics understands that. If you're a big donor, it doesn't matter if you back a loser. It doesn't matter if your strategy wasn't right. you are still going to be listened to because of the next election, not the last one. So that's number one. Number two about Sheldon Adelson, he gave a wonderful interview around that time where he said, look, you know, people think I'm some sort of terrible guy. I'm pro-choice. I'm sympathetic to gay rights. I have a lot of contacts with Israel, and Israel's got a national health care system. I think that's a really good idea. People should have health care. He's starting to sound like a social democrat, right? We're like all this stuff. But he says, and then a little bit of paraphrasing here, I give money because I want to have an influence on the process on things that I care about, like regulation of casinos or perhaps, you know, taxation, things like that. And so you understand it for a lot of these people, this is a transactional, not a transformational give. And the final thing I'd give you on that, just as regards Adelson, and again, I'm very cautious about the overemphasis on him because he's just the one who's talked publicly. But for a guy who lost, just remember, he didn't win at the presidential level, but he was one of the big donors in that Michigan referendum on labor rights. Right. And he's a guy that doesn't want strong unions. Mm-hmm. So that's the one side of your question as regards big donors and some of these people. Let's look at the other side on this popular outcry. That's the most interesting thing of all. If we had a media in the United States that actually covered politics, which we don't, by and large, our media it puts competing powerful interests together to argue about their talking points of the day. But that's not coverage of politics. That's not looking at what's really going on because politics is something broad and universal. If we covered politics in this country and covered grassroots movements as opposed to just what's going on in Washington, everybody would know that in 16 states across this country, people have formally petitioned either through referendums or official state action for Congress to overturn Citizens United. In over 500 communities, including Los Angeles, people have voted overwhelmingly for Congress to overturn Citizens United. There is a mass movement in this country to address these issues. It's real and it's out there, and people are aghast. They're horrified. They know this doesn't work. But the problem is, because there is so little coverage of mass movements in this country, of grassroots activism, we end up in a situation where a tremendous number of people feel overwhelmed and disempowered. What we tell people and what a big emphasis of the book is that, no, don't. That's the wrong reaction. That's exactly what they want. The fact of the matter is, if there's a point to dollarocracy, it is to argue, worry less about politicians and parties. Worry more about the structures of our democracy and whether they're working. And when you focus on that, you must become a part of a broad movement to overturn Citizens United. That's going to require a constitutional amendment. To guarantee the right to vote, that also will require a constitutional amendment. But do these things. Don't shoot low. Shoot high. And even if we don't get every constitutional amendment we want, understand the lesson of the great struggle for the Equal Rights Amendment in this country. Mm-hmm. We fought and fought and fought for an Equal Rights Amendment. We didn't get it. But in the process, we got Title IX. Right. We got protections for women in the workplace. We got some wage protections.
Right. Aim high, you might get some crumbs near the bottom.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, one of the stunning facts in your book, I want to talk about how money affects media. One of the stunning facts from your book, I want to quote, you said the Koch brothers could spend $150 million on political campaigns every day for a full year, and each of them would still remain among the 120 richest Americans. I mean, it's just unfathomable to think about that kind of money. So what effect does that money have on the media landscape that you were talking about earlier, Bob, is in its death throes? So you have this financially almost bankrupt industry, and you've got huge amounts of money. Of course, they're going to welcome it with open arms, and they have welcomed it with open arms.
Well, it's absolutely scandalous. We go into great depth in the book on the fact that we have $6 billion being spent on these TV ads now. Well, this money almost all goes to local TV stations. Now, when you say local TV stations, you think like ma and pa owning some local corner business. Now, these local TV stations in the last 20 years have been gobbled up by a handful of the largest media companies in the country, in fact, in the world. Companies like Disney and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation and Comcast.
Aaron Runyons is an associate professor at Pomona College in Religious Studies and Gender Studies and chair of the Department of Religious studies. She's the author of several books on intersection of biblical interpretation and culture. She's been an activist for many years working on police brutality and prison injustice, globalization, anti-war activism, feminist and queer organizing. She currently facilitates a writing workshop inside a women's prison in Chino and is involved in the struggle for environmental justice in the city of Pomona. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Our website is Uprising with Sonali.
They plan their financial budgets based on what they expect to get.
Much of the research for that section of the book comes from Wall Street analyst reports over the last few years.
Our theme music is by Kitsal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising.
They love this money.
Can I just let Bob finish for a second? They actually have futures. You know how you hear about the futures on the market? They have election futures. They're predicting what will be spent this year.
And so one of the other effects that these political ad campaigns have, aside from skewing the issue at hand, is that they also turn people off. And oftentimes they turn people off from voting, which, of course, is exactly what Sheldon Adelson, the Koch brothers, and Ted Cruz would be more than happy to have.
Well, I think you just hit on perhaps the most important thing that we came away from with all of our research. In a functional democracy, in a system where you actually wanted high participation, and many countries in the world do that, by the way. We study Germany a lot. We look at Scandinavia, but countries all over the world, India. There are countries around the world that want to have a high turnout. In fact, one of the funniest things is in Germany, prison wardens are among the job on their job description is to make sure that they have maximized turnout of inmates.
Wow.
They make sure
and
everybody
in our
votes.
Country, they don't even we don't allow them to vote.
So we got a lot of trouble, but one of the things that we come away from all this is if we could ask people to take in any lesson, it would be this. Negative political ads are a form of voter suppression. And we talk a great deal about voter ID laws, and we should. We talk a great deal about, changing the registration requirements, all the different things, all the gaming of the system that has occurred in states like North Carolina and other places around the country. But there's this overarching reality that negative political ads – effectively tell people, don't vote. And I know that somebody will push back and you say, well, hold it. No, they're saying don't vote for this guy. But do you understand what the message here is? You've got two candidates. Let's say you're a militant feminist, passionate in your commitment to the rights of women and to taking care of all, addressing all these issues that must be addressed. And you've got a candidate. I'm going to back that candidate. And then the other side puts on all these ads saying, well, that candidate's been horrible in this way. That candidate's been horrible in this way. You don't switch over to the right-wing candidate who's anti-abortion rights and stuff like that. You'd stand down, right? You say, oh, boy, everybody's bad. And it's the whole point of the negative ads is to make people who care, people who actually are interested, step back and say, boy, a pox on all their houses. And we have so little disrespect in the United States for low-income and disenfranchised voters that we presume they don't think about these things, right? In fact, they do think about these things, and they are inclined to participate. But when the media that they are most likely to get to have access to, right, which is the local evening news, the radio in the car, the things that don't cost a lot, right, when it's all packed with negativism, those are the people who often are the most likely to be talked into standing down or to be just convinced, it's hard enough to vote. Why bother to do it? And so we really as a country need to step back and think a lot about what we're doing as regards our politics. And we need to understand that other countries around the world, countries like Norway, say you can't run political ads before an election because that's like propaganda.
Right. My guests are John Nichols, the Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine, contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times, an associate editor of The Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and Bob McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The two of them wrote the book Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America.